לשידור ישיר ממחנה רמה בברקשיירס.
כל רמה 102.3 מגישים קיץ באוויר.
רדיו כל רמה 102.3 FM.
Shalom and welcome to another edition of Parsha Talk. I'm Rabbi Elliot Malamet in Highland Park, New Jersey, at the Highland Park Conservative Temple Congregation of Anshe Amen. And joining me, my good friends, Rabbi Jeremy Kalmanovsky, Anshe Chesed of New York City, Rabbi Barry Chesler, Solomon Schechter, Day School of Long Island. We are recording this on day 209, 210, and we are dedicating, of course, our study to comfort and to the hostages and to Israel, to Klal Yisrael, this sense that we are immersed in this very, very challenging time. And we're thinking about them, especially after having concluded Pesach. Pesach, I want to put this out to both of you. Pesach concludes on with us in the diaspora here, eighth day. We have a Yisker. And I always find that the end of Pesach is somewhat sad. For a couple of reasons. One, which is just a very practical reason, it's the end of a holiday. Two, congregational reason. You know, 2 days of Yontav, something's going to happen in the congregation. I had a person pass away in the congregation. That's always said. We have to kind of, you know, postpone a funeral till after. And three, of course, the main thing is that there's a little gate that we go through at the end of Pesach. And I understand the year is this, you know, this is the imagery of Jewish liturgy, Sha'arei, you know, the gates of all the different holidays, the gates of time. And I love that image because it just makes so much sense. We come to Pesach, we walk through a gate, burning the chametz, getting ready for the Seder, the Seders, the Yom Tov, the Chol HaMoed, the Shabbat Chol HaMoed, all the different moods. And then the end of Yontav with its readings and with its moods. And we enter the gates of Yisker, we exit the gates, and now there's a kind of emptiness. We you know, the Sephardim, God bless the Moroccans. They know how to do this well. They just
I so wish I was from Aleppo or
It's not too late.
It's too late for Aleppo.
We should explain what we're talking about. The Maimuna Festival. Of course, many of our readers, our viewers, listeners may come from this part of the world. We do not. Okay. And we envy. We have Sephardic envy. We have Moroccan envy.
Totally.
Because they have the Maimuna Festival. And they are just there. And Maimuna was about friends, their neighbors. Just, you know, they understood that these people didn't eat anything, no cakes, no nothing for 7-8 days. And they just plastered with these things, plied with pancakes and sweetbreads and all sweet milk, all things. And the truth is, for Ashkenazim go, another meal. We have to eat another meal.
It's a tuna for Shavuot.
Right.
But the Maimuna is a joyful, you know, way to close Pesach. Eighth day Pesach in Jerusalem, or when I was in Netanya a couple of years ago, I didn't appreciate, somebody didn't know the fact that Netanya is very, very, very heavily Moroccan and Tunisian. And Maimuna was a big day there that day.
So we do go into a different mode. We go out of the gate of Yisker. We don't generally have Maimuna in our communities. But what we do have is the national calendar of the Jewish people. And in just a few days from now, we are going to observe as communities and as a people Yom HaShoah, which was placed on the national calendar by the Knesset in Israel, Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, the Holocaust Remembrance Day, which...
Translate that a little bit more precisely.
Holocaust remembrance and heroism.
The day Yom HaShoah v'HaGivura, the day of catastrophe and heroism.
And heroism.
And I is this correct that the Nisan based date is somehow associated with the Warsaw Ghetto uprising? Is that true?
I think the original date that they wanted was the second day of Pesach, which was the beginning of the revolt, and that was not going to fly.
But because it's Chag,
yeah. And but what strikes me is the significance of the date is that it's in most years it's in a different week than Yom HaAtzmaut because it's 8 days between them, and I think it's important theologically because I think too often people are trying to make a connection between the Holocaust and the State of Israel, which I think theologically is indefensible.
So I personally. I once asked the great rabbi and great Holocaust theologian Yitz Greenberg if he felt that the Holocaust, the Shoah, would be folded into a kind of mythic narrative, like, you know, the destruction of the Churban Beit HaMikdash, the destruction of the first temple, the second temple, also the first temple, you know, it's folded into mythic narratives. There's sinat chinam. There's social hatred and dissension and pointless. And there's mivnei chataeinu galinu me'artzeinu. We were exiled because of our sins, and it's knit into a much bigger story than an event. And Yitz said, I certainly hope not. I hope it is never knit into. And I do feel I want to push back. I mean, I understand, you know, and this is well illustrated in the wonderful Tom Segev book called The Seventh Million about Israelis and the Holocaust. I do understand that Israelis' stock in trade is, we are tough, we would not go to the concentration camps. But Yom HaShoah is the story of 6 million dead and innumerable millions displaced. And HaGevura, militarily, is a side story. The inner Gevura, now that's significant. The inner Gevura, the inner heroism that enabled people to endure, I want to celebrate that. But I just, the whole thing that kind of centers or foregrounds one of a small number of military rebellions just seems to me a false note. Like, I think that the story of the Shoah is about the destruction of European Jewry and the inner resources of Am Yisrael that gave us the possibility to endure it and bounce back.
Look, I think we can differ on the way we understand the word gvura, and I think to go in the direction that you might want to go into, which is that, look, every day you survived was gvura, and none of us, of course, can totally comprehend what it took to survive, and we you know, as we enter these days, we can become quite immersed in stories and narratives and. I'm sure we have all grown up, and I still open myself to reading about the Shoah, you know, constantly. I've said in sermons and other teachings, you know, it's almost like there's a world here that almost every issue in the Shoah is like a masechet, a tractate on its own. And I once spent—I don't know if you recall this—you know, one summer I was so immersed in it. There was a big It was about 1,200 page book on the Warsaw Ghetto, all the scholarship on the Warsaw Ghetto, and I don't know what drew me. I needed to read every single thing about the Warsaw Ghetto, and including the maps, including, you know, the way that people organized and the way that they tried to, you know, just function on a daily basis, and that constitutes some gvura. It constitutes, you know, the yearning to live. I would even add, for example, the gvura of people after the Shoah in the displaced person camps, who were the most, it's the highest fertility rate on the Jewish people in Jewish history, which is the pent-up desire for life, that these people found each other, they married, and they began having children. I have a couple of, you know, many people in my shul who were born in DP camps and came to the United States in the late 40s after their parents picked up from their shattered lives and reconstituted their lives here. And of course, you know, the story of Israel, no matter how you want to separate the two, you really can't. And I understand, of course, that the history of modern political Zionism is goes back 100 years before the state of Israel. And of course, you know, there's an ample discussion and debate to have. But here's where we're going, which is that the Holocaust is the ur trauma of the Jewish people. There's no trauma like it. You can't even compare the destruction of the temples, no matter how, you know, some elements of our people would like to make the destructions of the temples to be the master catastrophe of the Jewish people. No, those pale in comparison, just on in scale to the destruction of European Jewry. And to a certain extent, here we are 80 years afterwards, and we're still kind of trying to figure out, how does this fit into the narrative? How does this fit into the liturgy? What do we do? I'll give you my example, and I want you to, you know, I'll test it out on you, which is, you know, over the years in my shul, we've been trying to do something where we create a liturgy around this day. So as we move from Mincha to Maariv, I have the ark, the light in the ark turned off. We put six memorial candles in there. We take all the Sifrei Torah out of the ark. And I explain to the congregation, as we take the Sifrei Torah, the ark, one, this is a symbol of the emptiness. There's nothing that could be more significant of question, of difficulty, of anguish, than seeing an empty ark. It's also the efforts that Jews made to sequester things, to hide. And we can't recreate that. There's a certain kind of obscenity in reenacting things, but here, this, we're only reaching for symbols. We daven, we chant our prayers in a kind of without festive melodies, and then we engage in the readings, and there are, you know, so many readings and testimonies, poetry, etc. We select every year, and then we recite names of either people in our families, people that we're related to, survivors who are no longer with us, which is another aspect of the holiday, the commemoration, and communities, and communities that we come from. I am a descendant of the community of Antipol in Poland. I've never been there. Of Kobryn, of Pinsk. These are places that are important in my imagination. I've seen the maps, I've read the books, I've read the testimonies. I'm immersed in that. It's a part of my mythic life. And the people, of course, that were taken out of these shtetls and part of the Einsatzgruppen and shot and buried in pits. So this is four generations, you know, before me. And it's still like, it's tactile in some way. And it's tactile for many, many people in my shul, and we're coming close to it. And so I put that out there as a kind of ritual, and I say it's a failure. It's always going to be a failure because nothing can really encapsulate it.
So I want to go in a slightly different direction. I don't know that it's a failure. I think that, you know, what happens sometimes is that we're not really used to watching history unfold. We're used to it being settled. And, you know, we have this idea, which is encouraged by our tradition, of course, that our tefillot, our prayers, and our prayer services sort of came almost deus ex machina from Mount Sinai, even though historically it's a result of hundreds of years of people doing things that finally crystallize in the services that we know. And, you know, what will be interesting, and we probably will not live to see it, is that I suspect in the next 50 years, things will crystallize, and that there may become a liturgy or a few liturgies that will become adopted by a number of different communities. Right now, it's kind of every community for itself because people don't quite know what to do, but I think things will settle in some way, and certain things will become meaningful for larger groups of people. And other things will fall by the wayside. You know, it's interesting to just think of our liturgy for a moment. So there are the Amidah concludes with a blessing for peace, which has a morning version and an evening version, because there were two different traditions. And so one was given to the morning and one was given to the evening. And something like that may happen with a Yom HaShoah liturgy, that some communities will adopt some things, other communities will adopt other things, but that a liturgy itself will finally crystallize and come into being.
I'm pretty skeptical about that latter point. Oddly enough, how did it happen? It's kind of, we know the fact that it didn't come Deus Ex Machina out of Sinai. And yet, in an ancient eras, when they did not have very effective means of communication among far-flung communities, liturgies, even though there's a difference between Ashkenazi and Sephardi, there's a difference between, Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Iran, the Iran liturgy and the Morocco liturgy and the France liturgy could differ. They're remarkably stable. And here in an era where we have incredible electronic communications, there's just a great profusion of difference. I'm a little skeptical that people, because of the diversity of communities and the lack of centralized authority, I think that they will continue to be diverse. People will pick different poems and stuff, and they'll. But clearly, one of the things that I think is going to be very different than X many years ago is, and it's the great challenge. First of all, I thought what you said was beautiful. The scene of the empty ark is the great challenge of memorializing the Shoah in the absence of actual survivors, and we are within 5 years or something like that of never having any actual survivors to know. And it's pretty incredible. I mean, it's hard to imagine for us who are, as you said, three, four generations from the European towns that our ancestors came from, knowing Shoah survivors and knowing their stories, firsthand, is just very, very central to us being Jews. And the need for us to mark it liturgically with the Tzvira in Israel, the siren, and the various kinds of poems and prayers that we recite, I think that gives it a kind of depth that it would lack otherwise. And it has to be communal. It can't just be, I personally sit and read my Primo Levi, although that's meaningful too. It has to be that we as a group get together and do this. I can throw in a poem later, but as you think about the liturgical or ritual markers, our listeners will certainly know that on Tisha B'Av, you don't put on tefillin until the afternoon. It's like the Hishlich Mishamayim Eretz Tiferet Yisrael, the glory of Israel was thrown to the ground, and so tefillin are considered a pe'er, some sort of beauty, and so they get displaced from the morning service. Rabbinic Jews couldn't say we wouldn't put them on at all that day. That would be bitul mitzvah tase. That would be just ignoring a mitzvah. So we displaced them until later in the day. There was a spot in my life. I said, I'm not wearing tefillin on Yom HaShoah, and I'm fasting. And even though fasting is counterindicated because it's in the month of Nisan, you're not supposed to fast in Nisan. I said, I'm going to fast on Yom HaShoah, and I'm not going to wear tefillin. And it just didn't work because I was the only person behaving in that way. And you can't have a ritual that's personal idiosyncrasy. And also fasting is kind of funny because people had real hunger. What if I skip breakfast one day? That's going to be like I'm somehow connecting with their experience. That's like a joke. But one year, there's a guy in my shul. His father was in Auschwitz. His father was sent on a work detail. And one year in the shul, he related the story that his father found a raw potato in the field, and he ate that potato raw. And he said it was the best thing he ever had in his life. And I said, okay, that's it. I'm going to do that. I'm going to eat a raw potato. It was so gross. It was so disgusting. I couldn't keep up. I couldn't keep up that ritual either.
Just let me react here, which is your desire to create a ritual is a desire of a of a symbolic reenactment of something, and I think we can relate to that in many, many different ways. Look, the thing that I proposed there was, I even, you know, said it's like a kind of minuscule micro reenactment of things that are beyond comprehension and the sense of terror that people had. And so, you know, in a sense, we come to these days with tremendous quandary, tremendous puzzle, without a canon, really. And you know, here we have to, you know, noticing that we don't have the canon, you know, complete of testimonies and poetry, et cetera, liturgy. We're kind of lost, you know. And in a way, it's look, we have a canon from when the people of Israel went into its first exile. We have, you know, that's where the Bible comes from. The Bible comes from the necessity to create the library that will tell over the story of the people and its origins and preserve its existence. And we have the museums and we have the narratives. We haven't gotten the Sanhedrin together and say, this is in, this is out. Elie Wiesel's in, Primo Levi's in, and who knows, whatever is out, you know, and because that's kind of absurd. It's an endless source of material, and it's an endless source of things to study. With your permission, I do want to raise this question, which is really the big question for this year. This year, these days are really hard. Because these days now are part of a larger context in terms of, you know, today we're now 210 days into the war. We are still in a sense fractured, broken from October the 7th. I think the healing is not even a word that you can use, even though there are indications, the process, there's the possibilities that people are at least attempting or trying in some ways, you know, putting back love. I hear, you know, podcasters talk about, I was in Tel Aviv and it's bustling and things are happening there. And, it, you know, on the one hand, you would never know. On the other hand, that's what everybody's talking about. So there's a kind of split screen here. But what I'm saying is that the October 7th language, which also includes things like the worst catastrophe since the Shoah to happen to the Jewish people in a single day, that's one. And, you know, you hear Yossi Klein HaLevi say, this was a prequel of the genocidal ambition. And so what that does is it awakens this kind of trauma, this ur-trauma of the Jewish people that the whole Jewish people is thrown into this national PTSD of having experienced near extermination 80 years ago in the Holocaust. We had a kind of glimpse of an attempt at an extermination, and that has rattled us and shaken us to places that we really can't fathom and are trying to recover from. And it's that serious. We take it that seriously. And so therefore I put out to you, you know, how do you react to this language? And how do you react to the question, what does it mean this year? So I'm gonna turn to you, Jeremy, first, pulpit rabbi.
Honor enough for a lifetime. One of my favorite lines about the Shoah is in Faith After the Holocaust by Eliezer Berkovich. It says, those of us who were not there, we are all Job's younger brother, which I think is an amazing line. People we love experience something we cannot even begin to put into words. This is feeling kind of present to me, the simultaneity of being a close witness and not an immediate participant, and being inaccessible to our words. I don't. That's maybe kind of what it is to be an American American Jew who loves Israel, who's not a citizen. I feel like you know, I'm the younger brother.
A relative, or you know, we're kind of lost too. We're trying to figure out this relationship. We're trying to, you know, emote in solidarity, or in the immortal words of the great Canadian poet Irving Layton, we ache in confraternity. We are aching in confraternity, but aching in confraternity is not aching in and being there, and this, I mean, that's a separate conversation in terms of how this relationship is moving through its different gates, as it were, through this year as well. I, you know, Barry, I don't know if you have any reflections on just language and how we use language to describe catastrophe, and the cautious way that we might want to use language, or the deliberate way that Yang.
So I think that we want to distinguish between two kinds of language. One is the language of words, and the other is the language of symbols. And one of the curiosities of Pesach is, of all of our holidays, it's the one that has the most symbolic meanings to it, right? We identify the salt water with tears of a slave, the charoset with mortar for bricks. But, you know, when we start to think about it, they don't actually encapsulate what we want them to, on one hand, but on the other hand, they still speak powerfully to us, even without the words, right? We identify in a certain way to the best that we can, even though we realize that the identification itself falls short. So one of the things that struck me this year in one of the Haggadahs I was using is a description of Pesach in one of the camps, where they made a bracha about how they wanted to have matzah this year, but they couldn't. But they still had to have Pesach. And I think that sometimes we...
So they made a bracha on chametz, right?
Yeah. We don't give ourselves enough credit for adapting to the circumstances and the situations that we're in. But the tradition that we've inherited and that we fashion day by day and hope to bequeath to our children and grandchildren has a lot of resources in it that a time like this might bring to the surface. And yeah, go on.
No, I was going to say, you know, reminding me of a passage in the Haggadah B'chol Dor V'Dor Chayav Adam Nir Otet Atzmo, and there was a reading in one of our supplements. I think the Neve Shechter supplement they produced. They had a poem that kind of had different layers of B'chol Dor V'Dor Chayav Adam Nir Otet Atzmo. Every generation, a person has to see him herself as, and they put different kind of emotional valences. It was very effective in the sense that there are different modes to this. You know, you have to see yourself as if you left Egypt. You know, do you have to see yourself as if you left Auschwitz? I think that's a very, you know, we can't make that leap, but can we see ourselves as being deprived? Can you see yourself as a hostage? I can't imagine what this is, you know.
Well, what would be the value of trying to imagine that?
I listen to Rachel Goldberg, Paul, and I listen to John, and I, Paul, and I'm going like, I so feel the sympathy for them, as well as the you know, the other families. They're not as well known to us, but these speak to us in English. They speak to the American audience and to the world audience, and we latch onto them in sympathy.
Right, but sympathy is not empathy.
Their loved one is our loved one. It's our family. It's us.
Right, but sympathy is not empathy. And I think that empathy makes the direct connection, which I don't think that we can make.
Yeah.
And that's why we're left with sympathy, where we remain on the outside, but we extend our comfort and consolation as best we are able. But we can't really, as you say, imagine what it's like to be a hostage. And we can't even really imagine what it's like to be the family of the hostage.
I think you're onto something very significant. The limits of imagination, it would be obscene to see. Like you can't say every person is bound to see themselves if they personally went out of Auschwitz. That would be obscene, because it would be appropriating an experience that blessedly we haven't had, and the people who have had it, it would be cheapening it. And Professor Alivni writes in his Holocaust memoir, you know, that he is very, very close with his grandfather, Professor David Weiss Alivni, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and they got to Auschwitz, and Mengele pointed them in whatever way. Alivni was 14 or 15 year old at the time. His grandfather was very aged, and Alivni just said, "I'm going the other way. Well, whatever's going that way, I'm going the other way." And as last he saw his grandfather, who went into the chambers and was dead in 20 minutes. And he writes in his memoir, we were separated on the train platform. I will not arrogate to myself the attempt to imagine something I cannot imagine. I cannot imagine the experience in the gas chamber. I wasn't there, and I will not cheapen it by trying to imagine it. And that seems to me very vivid. It seems to me vivid for this moment too. When I was in Israel in November, we met this woman, Ayelet Shachar, whose name appeared in the paper today, New York Times today, because Brett Stevens wrote about Sheryl Sandberg's movie about the sexual violence. And Ayelet Shachar is the mother of Naama Levy, who was one of the faces that you recognize on the hostage posters, and who was she was this terrible, terrible, you know, little clip of her being dragged by the ponytail through the streets of Gaza with like bloody sweatpants. And you can only assume, you know, the terrible abuse she suffered. And I met her in November. She was so articulate. I cannot even conceive of what she's been through since then. And I can't, and even she can't even say what her daughter's been through since then. It's the limitations of imagination that just feel very present. And I think we should probably try to incorporate the consciousness of those limitations whenever we think about these terrible, terrible events, present time and time minus 80 years.
Right. And so what we're left with is the traditional way that we comfort someone, which is by showing up and not speaking. Because the language of presence is more important than words which seem empty.
So you do need some kind of liturgy then. You do need some kind of vocabulary.
That comes in time, though. That doesn't come right away.
So we have the...
You know, the words of the tradition is you can't comfort someone whose dead has not been buried yet.
Oh, understood. So we
see... Yeah. I mean, I think one more thing, which is... I'm hankering to read this poem, but it's okay. I'm going to let it go. But in 1943, Avraham Shlonsky was a leading poet in Israel, pre-state Israel. And the poem is called Neder. And the key thing is, I make this vow to remember everything and forget nothing, and not to go back to normal, tomorrow morning, having learned absolutely nothing yet again. And so I do think that is not, that kind of imaginative response is not, chayav adam lirot etzmo ki'ilu hu nitzol shoah, that like a person is bound to consider themselves as Holocaust survivors. That would be obscene. Or October 7th survivors, that would be obscene. But it is to say that our society can't be the same as it was before. And that's a vow that I think that we all should be able to make, that we're not going to just go back to normal.
Right. I think that's a very important point. But I want to add one other thing. The reason why we have to imagine that we left Egypt is because we identify that with the saving power of God. We don't identify the other things that we've mentioned with the saving power of God. And that's why we don't imagine ourselves in those situations. We don't imagine being slaves, really. We imagine coming out of Egypt. Those are two different experiences. And I think that part of the limitations that you were talking about, Jeremy, are also limitations on the way that we relate to God. And God, in a certain sense, cannot be everywhere anymore the way he possibly was for our ancestors.
There are
places in the world where God is not present.
I think that that's the conundrum. I mean, we've come to the end here, but
it's Hester Panim.
This is the conundrum of the show, which is you're trying to evoke and create a liturgy in the darkest abyss, or you know, it's the theological black hole, and nothing can come out of it. It's the region, it's the zone of blackness. I mean, we have in my shul, we have these windows that depict Jewish history, and for the Shoah, we have just one black pane because it's mm-hmm. impossible. There's no light. It's this one darkness. On the other hand, okay, so as I mentioned, yeah, I have libraries and libraries and libraries of things, and we can't stop talking about it. I can't stop reading about it. I mean, can't stop framing our own understanding of the world without you know, thinking about it. So
we need to end on some element of hope. And one of the things I think is important to remember is that in our lifetime, we've seen the way that the Holocaust is remembered and memorialized changed. In the early days, it was about destruction. The early books, you know, Raoul Holberg's The Destruction of East European Jewry. But now a lot of museums are more concerned with the lives that were led before the Holocaust. And it's important to remember that the people who died were actually living human beings just like us. You know, they had families, they had loves, they had losses. And that's what we need to incorporate into our lives. Not just the way that they left this world, but the world that they tried to create in their daily lives.
Yeah. Again, it's an endless conversation. And of course that's one avenue into it, is to see the sanctification of life and to remember them as they lived and not only as in the way that they were killed and persecuted. So we enter these gates now through this week ending Pesach. And, you know, with Klal Yisrael, with the entire Jewish people, going from this moment to Yom HaShoah and beyond in a very, very challenging year. And hoping that our viewers and listeners have gotten some meaning out of this conversation. We thank you for joining us, as always. We appreciate your presence with us. We look forward to having this conversation with you on the next edition of Parshat Talk. Have a wonderful Shabbat, everyone.
Shabbat Shalom.
רדיו קול רמה 102.3 FM. קול רמה.